consideration of Thessalonians to continue. Brother Mac, please. Brother Mac.
Good evening, everyone. I'd like to thank our pianist this evening for playing. We seem to be having a bit of advantage of late, in as much as we've had some of our young sisters volunteering. I guess it's that way, volunteering to help out with the playing of the organ and with the piano. It's very good because she actually chose a hymn that fits in with consideration of chapter 3 this evening, when Paul draws a lot on the subject of walking aright before our God so that at the appointed time we might receive the crown that our King will give to us if we are faithful. And that was a concluding verse of that hymn, a beautiful hymn, as we sang together, reminding us of God activating and being active in the seasons that come and go, as we have seen at this particular time. We have had an abundance of rain. Remember, the prophet told us that that would be the situation, that the rains would, because of his control of the conditions of the earth, it would be necessary to have the rain to bring forth fruit from the earth. And so he, as the prophet said, that so the word that would go forth would not return in vain, but it would achieve for the reason that it was sent. So this is especially in consideration of the Apostle Paul's letters to the different ecclesias and of his books that are concluded in the Holy Oracles and in this particular way. In this, remember we've been studying this particular letter for about 2 or 3 weeks now, and last week we considered chapter 2, and we remember at that particular time the Apostle Paul telling the brethren and sisters there how he was concerned and had a great desire to return to them. We know that Paul has been forced to leave Thessalonica, and he has gone into other parts, and but his main concern was of their spiritual conditions. And he wanted to go there because he knew that his company would help them. So when we concluded last week, we were in the about halfway through this first letter. And so we like you to zoom in on this letter, as I say, about halfway into the verses of 18 and 19. And so with this, with the Apostle Paul's letter, if you follow it closely and read it maybe more than once, you sense an emotion that is creating an atmosphere in the life of Paul and in woven into the writings of this letter. He wasn't an emotional man. We know on more than once, maybe once he was in the company of his brothers and sisters, and tears came into his eyes because of the situation at hand. And so he was concerned about their spiritual lives, because he was aware that there were those who were opposed to him, and more so to the ecclesia. And so the reason for this was because, as he says earlier on, that he was afraid that they would be persuaded to refrain from believing in God and doing things contrary to the will of God. And so he said, it's possible that the tempter will come in amongst them to turn them away, following the footsteps of Jesus Christ. And he said, this would be done in the way of the Satan, who would be averse and put blocks in their ways. Now this tribulation, trial, and difficulty, or the tempter, wasn't so much a physical abuse, but it was more of a mental attack to break down their spirit and to change their way of thinking regarding the teaching of the Apostle Paul. And we know that the opposition was came from the Jewish element. There were certain Jews who were averse to what Paul was preaching, and one of their teaching was that they should remain with the law of Moses, and they saw the Apostle Paul as preaching different to this, preaching of a man who came out of Nazareth called Jesus, and they've been encouraged to follow him. And so we know that they hunted him down. They literally hunted this man down from one place to another to steal him. They didn't want to come out and assassinate him in the open, but they wanted to break him down mentally so that he would either become sick and useless to continue this work, or that he would refrain from doing it. Nevertheless, he was telling them that they were still his joy and crown. He wanted them to know this, just as we sang in that hymn, as he says here. Nevertheless, they said, verse 18, wherefore we would have come unto you, even I, Paul, once again. We're anxious for this. He tried every method to go and visit them, but it seemed to be hampered and dampened in this ability to do this. And so it says in verse 18 of chapter 2, wherefore we would have come unto you, even I, Paul, once and again, but Satan, or the adversary, hindered us all the way. Nevertheless, he says, nevertheless, I want you to know that I find strength and comfort in the awareness that my preaching wasn't in vain to you as an ecclesia. He said, because you are my hope, you are my joy, you are my crown of rejoicing, and greater still, my greater hope and advantage would be, and blessing would be, when I see you in the presence of our Lord Jesus Christ is coming. So this is what he's doing. He's telling them what joy they had given to him, and how he looked upon them as being this a time of rejoicing and the wearing the crown of salvation. But it will be fulfilled and made complete when Jesus returns, and he will see them in the presence of Jesus Christ. He had this wonderful faith and vision to be able to visualize this. And that's a little difficult for us. We know that our faith should maybe motivate us this way, but we know that it's very difficult to believe in things that we can't see. But the Apostle Paul had this vision, had the ability, like others, to be able to focus to such an extent that he was there in the presence of Jesus Christ. And one of the joys and one of the rejoicing would be at that time is rejoicing and joy would be made complete when he could look down on the Redeemer of the Lord surrounded in the temple of worship. There Jesus was. And look on it and see some of the brethren and sisters from the Thessalonica ecclesia there. And you could almost see him raising his hands in satisfaction that my sacrifice was not in vain on your behalf, even as Jesus Christ would say the same thing. And so these are the words that make up verse 19 and 20. And so with the true believer, he would receive the victor's wreath when he had won the race of life, just as we have then here. Now, there's a wonderful thing. This is the same with all types of preaching, even in our own course of preaching today with brethren who get up and exhort on the platform and the lecture. They sometimes, and quite often actually, they draw lessons from life of what they've seen, what they've experienced. I'll be doing this a little later on in the consideration of this chapter 3. And so the Apostle Paul draws on an event that is about to happen. We don't have too much of an illustration or demonstration of this in the script in his letter here, but we're supported by historians. And Ramsey, one of the well-known historians, he informs us that about this time, when Paul was writing this letter, that the Thessalonians were due to a visit of a very important person. They would be receiving, or in that area, an imperial state about this time, when no doubt the religious ceremonies of the Olympics would be performed in his honor. And there would be this triumph, there would be this wonderful atmosphere of this visit. And everybody would be focused in on this individual, the royalty who would become. And so with the all the festivities going on, the royal dignity would present the crown of exalting to the victor by his grace. And so this, it almost seems that this is what Paul draws on to amplify the possibility, if they remain steadfast, and they will have this joy of seeing this, see royalty come be a part of their life, and if, as the hymn went, they will receive the wreath or the crown of the victor. Now we can ask the questions regarding these letters. How important are these letters to our salvation? They're letters. How important are they to affect our eternal salvation? Well, God, I believe, and is supported by the fact of the amount of letters we have in the New Testament, God, I believe, looked on these letters as the potter, the potter's hands that move, and to knead, to mold, and to remove the weak parts, the unclean parts, and mold them into vessels fit for his house. That is the way I see the power of the teaching of Paul, that it literally would take hold of individuals of the Ecclesia of Thessalonica and literally reshape them, or as it was spoken in the exhortation on Sunday, it would transform them. It would be a renewing of the mind. It would create a person different to what had first entered the waters of baptism. It would be a beautiful thing in the sight of God if it was achieved that way through the power of these letters. These letters, to me, were so important in the eyes of God that out of the 27 books that we have in the 27 books that we have in the New Testament, the Apostle Paul has 14 letters inserted there. So important were these letters. We have Peter, as we know, writing a letter, and we have the gospel record. But almost two-thirds of the New Testament is a collection of the Apostle Paul's letters. So important was his letters, not alone to the Jews, but more so to the Gentiles. It was involved with a New Testament, a new covenant was being made. And as we know, the Apostle Paul, on Acts 9, that he was a spearhead that went forward and would do this. He would break down those who would oppose those that God would call, and so on. And we're told this, that these believers should realize and recognize that what God had bestowed upon us. They were to, as he says in chapter 3 and at verse 84, he says, "For now we live if we stand fast in the Lord." And so if they would follow the teaching of the Apostle Paul, if they would actually consume these letters and put them into action, that's what it's got to be, put them into action, then they would be able to, they would live to Christ, and they would stand fast in the Lord, and it didn't matter what opposition would get them, they were now made so strong, so fortified, that nothing could break down their spirit to remain faithful to them. Going back to, the responsibility is made known to us when the Apostle Paul writes to them and tells them what responsibilities they have, and what a privilege they have. I think we underestimate this sometimes. But he says in chapter 2 and at verse 4, he says, but I've got the Amplified Bible here, and I like that. I like it actually better than in studying the Scriptures. This way, I want to read that verse from this translation. Thessalonians 2 and at verse 4. It says there, this is from the Amplified Bible, but just as we have been approved by God, we've been approved, selected by God to be entrusted with the glad tidings or the gospel, so we speak not to please men, but to please God, who tests our hearts, expecting them to be approved. So what he's reminding them there is that they have been approved and appointed and selected to be carriers of this world, the word of God, or guardians of it. And he emphasizes these kind of things to make them realize how important it is for them to follow in this way. So he says, all these things that I've written and said to you, it's to this end. And we'll take again into the Amplified and at chapter 2 and at verse 12, he says this. The word is given to you and to be worked on you and to transform you. In verse 12, he says, to live lives worthy of God. That's the power of the word. That's the main purpose of these letters, was to persuade these men and women to live lives worthy of God. And if they're worthy of God, then they will become Paul's crown and joy. To live lives worthy of God, who calls you into his own kingdom and the glorious blessedness into which true believers will enter after Christ returns. And you'll find that the Apostle Paul is a deep concern that these brethren and sisters were beginning to lose contact with the fact that Jesus is going to return. They were losing this touch, this precious touch would anchor them to following in the footsteps of Paul as he was of Jesus Christ. And so he informs us in that particular way that we should walk worthy of the things that they were hearing. So it is, brothers and sisters. The Apostle Paul thanked God for his brothers and sisters in this particular ecclesias, as he does in others. And so we also, which I think we neglect, although sometimes it comes up, we fail to maybe in our present thank God for one another. Now that seems to be strange language, but we thank God for one another. We thank God for those who sacrifice their time to remind us of this, of our high calling and what God expects of us. To give witness to his glory and desire as God that all might be saved. Now, we have to, we remember last week, last Sunday we had two excellent talks, the exhorting brother and the lecturing brother. The exhorting brother, like us, he had devoted his time in studying and reading another letter, the letter to Philippi. Now, it's interesting to see that if you follow through, if you read these letters, and if you could read the letter to Thessalonica and the letter to Philippi at the same time, you'll really recognize there's a similar language and a similar appeal and similar subjects that are discussed. And so the exhorting brother, Sunday, he gained his theme or got his theme from the letter to Philippi and enlarged on it, informing us of the desire and necessary move that we should make in transforming our lives and change our minds from that which is of the flesh to that which is of Christ. And so the Apostle Paul, favorite ecclesia, I believe, in reading all his letters, was these two churches, or these two ecclesias. I used to listen to A.D. Norris, and he didn't always like the word church or ecclesia, and he would always refer to the gathering of brothers and sisters as the congregation. He preferred to call them the congregation in this way. So, in the thoughts from the exhortation, we remember the desire, the necessity to become have a newness of mind. And so I just want to go to with this idea in mind, because it's also part of the calling of Paul in his letter to Philippi, that there must be transformation, there must be change. And if we don't, if we can't look back on our lives and see that there's been a change in our character, in our makeup, in our desire for things that are spiritual, then there is something wrong with our lives. There has to be something dramatic in that way. And the Apostle Paul was not afraid of pulling punches. And so he said, look, if you want to be a friend of Jesus, if you want to find the kingdom, then you've got to put to death certain things. You've got to get rid of certain things. You've got to destroy certain things, because there's no room in your mind for both. One will counteract the other, and so it is in this way. So in Galatians chapter 4, verse 24, this is the strong language that he uses. And he says, he's speaking about the fruits of the Spirit, the thing that should inhabit our minds, the love, the joy, the peace, the long-suffering, gentleness, and so on. And then he says, and they that are Christ have crucified the flesh with the afflictions and lusts. And that's what that's within the contents of the letter to Philippi, to the Philippians. And then that was also in the Thessalonica. He says, you've got to destroy those things which can affect you, the afflictions and the lusts. And know we in our own lives have many afflictions and many temptations of the flesh. We have to be strong in the spirit to be able to put them to death. So it will happen if we have this renewing of the spirit world in this way. So the lecturing brothers went on. Ty dovetailed the exhortation very well, because he went on to carry with the same theme, saying that you've got to be different people. And Paul said, as the speaker said in a very strong language, that there's got to be this dramatic change. Why? Because God calls us to be witnesses to his world. And if we're not different, then it will never have any effect on your neighbor, on your friends, or the world in general. We have to be different people in this world to be recognized and to be known why we're different. And so the lecturing brother reminded us, where it is written in Hebrews, that we should become strangers and pilgrims upon the earth. And if the world doesn't see us as different, then we are of the world. If the world doesn't see us, then we're not very good witnesses. If the world doesn't see us, then Jesus, the Prince of Jesus, has had no effect upon our lives. We have to be different. We have to do something with our lives. And so this, when I'm listening to these two talks on Sunday, a little incident that happened in my life, or in our life, my wife and I, some time ago, was that of an incident that happened when we were visiting Hornby and Devon Island. To do with what a person can do with their life. It's remarkable what people can do. And so we were spending some time over on Hornby Island, and we happened to meet up with a Chinese man. And we got chatting to him, and he invited us into his lovely home. And we sat down and talked about different things. And he says, we're talking about what we've done with our lives. And he says, I'll tell you my life story. And so he gave us his life story, which was very interesting and fascinating. And to me, it was an exhortation in itself, what one can do when one has nothing and can do everything. And so what he told us was that he was born in Hong Kong, and too many children at home, and his parents sent him to Vancouver to his grandfather. His grandfather didn't want him. Grandfather had no time for him, and his grandfather would not feed him. So his grandfather kicked him out on the street. He had no money. He had nobody to care for him. But he became quite efficient at playing marbles. And so he'd play marbles at the school grounds. And with marbles that he won, which were many, he would sell them and then buy food for himself. Later on, as he walked the streets in Vancouver and Chinatown, an elderly man met him up and told him he shouldn't be on the streets and that he should be doing something with his life. Make it worthwhile. You're living a wasted life. And so this man took him under his wings and he taught him how to be a potter. How to be a potter, the working of clay. And what he did, he said, some of the finest clay that he was able to obtain was the black clay from Mount Dung. And he became so efficient with this and so dedicated to this that he was going to be the best in this that at the later on in his life, he did such wonderful works and created vessels to the extent that when the queen came, to Vancouver or to Canada, his work was presented to royalty. I thought how wonderful that. This young boy had nothing, but he rose up in the ranks, and to his own satisfaction, to be able to create these things that he might present them to royalty when it came. If you look in, if you go into Vancouver Airport sometime, look into the glass cabinets there, you'll see some of the pottery work that was his handiwork. So this is just, as I say, to me, with an exhortation that you have nothing, but you can create a vessel of honor that will be fit for the house of God when Jesus returns and the temple is established again. Just a little bit of homework at this time. There's two questions that came up while studying this. Homework was, did the Apostle Paul ever return to Thessalonica? That's the question that Jamie would know. And did Paul ever return to Thessalonica? And the other question is, who gave Saul the name Paul? We know the names, the meaning of the names, at what time, and who gave it to him in that particular way. Was it Barnabas? Was it one of his friends? Does it matter? In some ways it does matter, because in those names we can see, like that young Chinese boy, the changing, the grafting in of the word in his life. And Paul, Saul, was nothing in the eyes of God. He was nothing to him, but he took hold of his own life. He was converted. And so when his closing days, he knew that he was in a situation to present himself acceptable to royalty, to Jesus the Christ, the King. So going into chapter 3 then now, we commence this section of his letter when we read in verse 1 and 2, "Wherefore, when we could no longer forbear, we thought it good to be left at Athens." So this is part of the second journey, and what the Apostle Paul found now is the difficulty within that ecclesia, that he had no peace of mind of all the problems and the difficulties that are going on at that particular time. And it wasn't alone just these Jews, the zealous Jews that were there. They dogged him everywhere. They were there. They were filtering into the ecclesia under disguise that they wanted to be part of the ecclesia. And they were persuading the congregation to turn against Paul. And what he's preaching was false. And they should stay with the law of Moses or have nothing to do with this man who called himself the apostle unto the Gentile. So he said, we couldn't take it any longer. Remember, the apostle Paul was not weak spiritually, but Apostle Paul was weak physically. And he would be hard upon him because this would wear him down, this constant badgering, this constant attacking to him, and mostly verbally. It told on him. And so he knew that he had to leave for the benefit of the further work, that he could go elsewhere and to preach where the word would be acceptable. So he says, we could no longer forbear, we thought it good to be left at Athens. So some of the brethren saw to it that he was transported and removed safely from Thessalonica and to go to Athens, where he hoped that he would be able to preach the word. And we leave that at that time. So the condition was that he was absent, and it says in verse 2 that he had brethren with him who were helpers. This is where Paul got some of his strength was. He had many friends in Christ and those who would support him. At this particular time, Timotheus was with him, our brother and minister of God, our fellow laboring the gospel of Christ, to establish you and to comfort you concerning your faith. So he's decided that, seeing that he could go, he would send this young man, Timothy, and he would seek them out and see what they were doing, how they were managing with this opposition. Don't forget there was these Jews that were dogging him, but there's also trouble in the ecclesia. When we read the, we go into chapter 4 and 5, we say there's trouble there. So he had this more reason maybe to go and let things work themselves out as he went elsewhere. So remember that when we go into Acts chapter 17 and 18, we have the full details from his journey from then on. Leaving Athens, in Acts chapter 17, 18, you have there the outlay of what happened after when he was at Athens and when he left there and went to Corinth. Remember there he said, verse 1, now when they had passed through Amphipolis and Apollonia, they came to Thessalonica, where was a synagogue of the Jews. And Paul, as his manner was, went to the synagogue, opening and alleging that Christ must needs have suffered and risen again from the dead, and that this Jesus whom I preach unto you is Christ, or is Jesus the Christ. And so we remember that when he went into Athens, he debated with the, in verse 18, he debated with certain philosophers. He had this location in Athens, which we've seen in our travel, that location, the ideal location where he preached from. And he debated there and felt confident that he could deal with them and maybe even persuade them to Christ. But then certain philosophers of the Epicureans and of the Stoics encountered him and said, some said, what would this babbler say? Others, some, he seemeth to be a setter forth of strange gods because he preached unto them Jesus and the resurrection. That's what they opposed, was that he was preaching that Jesus of Nazareth was their real Messiah in this way. And so he preached there, and then we know that he left Athens a very depressed man. He, as some of us, when we get up this on the platform, we go home and think, oh, certainly didn't do a good job of that. And it's a little depressing for an individual in that when they're trying to do the best thing. But this was the trouble with the Apostle Paul. When he left Athens, he was a very depressed man. He felt he hadn't achieved anything in preaching in Athens. And when he left Athens, he went to Corinth. And so we remember he wasn't in a very good mood there. And so it was, as always, that under such conditions, if we lean heavily upon Christ, then he will come to us and reassure us that it all is well. And this is what happened, he says in verse 9. Then spake the Lord to Paul in the night by a vision. He had this vision. And in the vision, I'm sure he saw a Jesus or an angel, but whoever it was said, be not afraid, but speak and hold not thy peace, for I am with thee, and no man shall set on thee to hurt thee, for I have much people in the city. In other words, I'm not finished with you, Paul, yet. There's lots more work to do. And you will find strength again after the experience of that. You'll find comfort and strength again when you see that your words will have effect upon people, and some of them will be converted to Jesus Christ. And so this this need to send Timothy, we know, was ideal in his choice. Timothy, as we know, he was known to Paul as his brother, a minister of the word, a minister of God, and a fellow laborer. As we know, the name of Timothy means to be of God. And truly he was a man of God. We know that he was like that Chinese man. We know that he, like many of us, that at one time he was not doing too much with his life. And Paul, remember, when he went to his home, said, Timothy, you've got to stand back up on your feet and take control of your feelings and your life. And we remember, do we not? Paul told me, he said, there's a fire that's burning in your heart, but you won't let it go. That fire should be warming the hearts of other people and give them comfort. And that's what you are. And that's what what Paul says. He says, I'm sending you, Timothy, to establish and to comfort you concerning your faith, that no man should be moved by these afflictions and these problems and difficulties, for yourselves know that we are appointed thereunto. And so this young man went to Thessalonica for two reasons. Two reasons Paul says you're going to go there. One is to set firm and comfort them in their faith. He was to them the comforter, to comfort them in their lives. And the other was to know of your faith. I want to know of your faith, lest by some means the temper had taken hold of you and persuaded you, as he says in verse 5. For this cause, when I could no longer forbear, I sent to know your faith, lest by some means the tempter have tempted you, and I labor but in vain. This is what he was concerned about, that all his efforts were now in vain, and they were a lost cause. And so Timothy, the young man, went, as we know, and he loved. It's not very often you see this relationship within the brotherhood, or within ecclesia, of a relationship between an elder and with a young person. It's very rare you see a real deep association with brother to brother or sister to sister. But with the Apostle Paul, I think it's a wonderful example of this, that as we know, it's possible the Apostle Paul never had any children. But he adopted into his life this young man, Timothy, to such an extent that he called him my son. So when you go to 1 Timothy chapter 1 and 2, Paul is not afraid of telling Timothy how affectionate he was towards him and as a father to a son. And in the 1 Timothy chapter 1 and 2, he says, unto Timothy, my own son in the faith, in this way. So Timothy was going to go there and observe what is happening and take back to the Apostle Paul his fact-finding, and he prayed that it would give Paul a greater desire and energy to carry on with his work, though he could not visit this ecclesia at this time. The whole purpose of this letter, as we have said, is that the ecclesia should remain faithful and not be persuaded to lose faith, whatever problems and difficulties came upon them. They had to realize, as Paul says, and maybe we should, that no man should be moved by these afflictions. What he's saying there is that no man should be swayed one way or the other. That's the meaning of that word, moved, to be persuaded to move one or the other. Or as he said later on, to stand fast in the Lord and not be moved at all. And he said that no man should be moved by these afflictions, for yourself know that we are appointed thereunto. That's what he's saying. He says, if you're a real disciple of Christ, if you're a minister of Christ, if you're a workman in God's vineyard, then you're going to have problems and difficulties. It comes with the territory of a disciple. It's part of the activity and as a workman in the vineyard of God. And so the Apostle Paul, as we know, knew this quite well, because God even had to inform him on this right from the start when he was converted. Remember that when he, in his conversion, that God said, I'm calling you, Paul, to be an apostle unto the Gentiles. And Paul said, well, that sounds good. But, he says, we almost see that word being inserted in there. But, he said, if you fulfill this role of the apostle unto the Gentile, you will have afflictions. You will have difficulties in all that way. It comes with the territory. As we know, we read of that, I believe, in Acts chapter 9. I don't want to go to it because I think this is important for us to know, brothers and sisters. We may, if we Christ remained away, we may, if troubles get worse in our world, that we will have to make a stand. We will have to make a stand, and we may suffer because of it if we are true witnesses of God. And so it says in Acts 19, when there's, as we know, Paul, who was then Saul, had been visited, he says, but the Lord said unto him, go thy way, for he is a chosen vessel unto me to bear my name before the Gentiles and kings and the children of Israel. For I will show him how great things he must suffer in my name's sake. I will show him the pain that he will have to endure if he fulfills that role as an apostle and a minister of Jesus Christ. So in this way, and time and time again, he informs us about this in this particular way. A brother once said, regarding the question of living the truth, of being an example of the world, a brother, I listened to a conversation between two brethren at one time while I was in England as a young boy. And it was during the end of the war, and one brother said to the other, those brothers and sisters back in Paul's day and that, they had a hard time living the truth. They really had a tough time living the truth. And the brother said, no, they didn't. He says, they had an easier way of living the truth. And the brother said, how is that? He said, well, the way it was, they were confronted as to who they were and what they were doing, and they had to stand up. They had to stand up and be a witness to the things that they believed in. So it forced them, or it made them, become a true witness of Jesus Christ. So the brother said, it's harder actually to live the truth today because we don't have that challenge. We don't, you talk with people today about religion and about your church and about, don't worry about the things that happen upon the earth, because it all will be made right in time that when Jesus returns to this earth. And they say, they've been saying that for a long time. And don't worry about it. Everything will work itself out. And we don't want to talk about religion. We're all going to the same place. So that this lukewarmness regarding an interest in God and the teachings of Jesus Christ. So this is why we have to, because brothers and sisters, there could be too many comfortable pews. We come here Sundays, Thursday nights, some of us, and we listen to these talks, and we're quite confident that we're living a good life for Christ. But we spend more time outside there than here, and more time out there it should be given over to being a true witness to God. If we preach the gospel, if people know who we are, then we will have afflictions and difficulties and tribulations. Not necessary in physical, but in different ways. I had a little bit of that when I reached the age of 18. I was called up to go into the army, and I was fairly popular in the area that I was in, with activities in sports and everything else. And I was called up at 18, and when I went there to register as a conscience objector, there were about 50 of my friends there also, and a man, and I went into the wrong lineup, and a man asked me what I intended to do, which forces one, and I said I am a conscience objector very quietly, so that my friends couldn't hear, and he stands up there and shouts out, This boy is a conscience objector. Go down the other end. And of course, all my From then I got quite a bit of abuse, friend. But it wasn't so physical, a little bit, but not too much. But the thing that hurt me was the emotional thing, and as much as my friends wouldn't walk on the same side of the street as me. They'd see me coming, they'd walk on the other side and make some silly remarks about me being afraid to fight. I could have answered them that, but I left it at that particular time. So the Apostle Paul, in his lifetime, and with this occasion when he sent Timothy to Thessalonica, he said, "You'll be a comfort to them, and comfort you concerning your faith," and so on. This is something of a parallel with Jesus Christ. If you go to John 16 and 19, you'll see there that. Remember that Jesus Christ, in the life that he lived, and that he also used some of his friends to go forth and help him in the preaching of the gospel. We have a bit of a parallel between what is happening with Paul and Timothy and Jesus with some of those of his disciples. And so in verse 19 of John 16 it says, "And now Jesus knew that they were desirous to ask him." Jesus knew that they were desirous to talk to him. And he said unto them, Do you inquire among yourselves of that I said, a little while, and ye shall not see me, and again a little while, and ye shall see me? That's like Paul with the Thessalonica, as we later on in reading that chapter 3. They wanted to see Paul as much as he did that. And then in John chapter 14 and the verse 18, it says there, I will not leave you comfortless, I will come to you. See the parallel between Jesus and Paul, and that's what Paul said. When he wrote the letter to you, he said, I won't leave you altogether, I won't leave you comfortless, I will send Timothy who will be a comfort unto you. So they were, as they know, they were comforted by Timothy. They liked Timothy. Paul wasn't allowed to go to Thessalonica, but some reason, I think Timothy was of a different type of character in some way, and so they allowed Timothy to go and stay with them for a little while. Now in verse 9, we're moving down in the chapter a little bit. If you go down into verse 9 and 10, you'll see there that Paul wants them to know that he is constantly with them, not when he went into the synagogue and joined in prayer, but he is with them 24 hours a day through the power of prayer. For he said, "For what thanks can we render to God again for you? For all the joy wherewith we joy for your sake before our God. We have prayed night and day, praying exceedingly that we might see your face and might perfect that which is lacking in your faith." This is what he wanted to do. He wanted to build up their characters of their faith. "Now God himself and our Father and our Lord Jesus Christ direct our way to you." And he was being directed inasmuch as he communicated with them. He had fellowship with them through the power of prayer. And I often wonder, how prayer is, as we know, an individual thing. But I often wonder how involved we are in prayer. I rely more on prayer now than I did 40, 50 years ago. I spend more time in prayer now than I did before. I don't necessarily pray by my bed long prayers, but I pray more often throughout the day, what I call minute prayers. And I think they're quite effective for those that I'm praying for and for my own salvation. And the Apostle Paul said that he was praying with them, and the language is nice. He says, "Night and day I'm praying exceedingly that we might see your face." And that word exceedingly, there is an unusual word. The word means to overflow abundantly. Here again, the Apostle Paul takes the advantage of the surroundings, just the same Jesus did with parables and such like. And so he says, My prayers are not spasmodic. They're not just not occasional exercise, spiritual exercise. He said, but I pray night and day, praying exceedingly. And that word exceedingly there is, and in the usual world, it means to flow abundantly. To flow abundantly. So what the Apostle Paul is saying, he's taken a scene of those things at Thessalonica. And one of the tourist attractions of that city was, they had these great powerful springs, the hot springs. And so the city, when it was originally named, it was called Therma, as in thermostat, as in a thermos, that way. It was changed later on from Therma to Thessalonica. So this is what he's drawing on here. So he knew that the people would get this visual exhortation that when he spoke in this way, they would say, Paul may be hinting that his prayers were like these springs, these hot springs. They were overflowing in that way. And we have that kind of language in the psalm when it talks about the blessings of God being overflowing in that way. And so we're concluding in this chapter here. And he said, the Lord God make you to increase and abound in love one towards another, toward all men as we do towards you or want to do it. There's an interesting thing that maybe we don't get enough of it, the preaching of the coming of Christ today. When I was a boy, as most of you, when Christadelphian lectures were given in England, almost every other Sunday, the preacher would preach on the subject, the coming of Jesus Christ. Christ is coming. That was one of the famous ones. And in the windows in the houses of England, almost every other week, you see there's going to be a lecture at the Christadelphian Hall, and it's going to be on the coming of Jesus Christ. We don't have those too much today. We don't have that fervor to pray for the coming of Jesus Christ. But Paul, this ecclesia, Jesus had only been away about 20, 30 years, and now they were becoming lukewarm about this event that was to happen. So Paul had to constantly drive it home to you that the promise of the angels on the Mount Olive was still in effect and would be fulfilled. So what we have in this chapter, we have what we call the Advent verses. We have these Advent verses, and I can just give you three illustrations. You can find the others for yourself. In chapter 1 and in verse 10, it says, we want you to wait for his Son from heaven, whom he raised from the dead, even Jesus, which delivered us from the wrath to come. That's in that there. And then we go to chapter 2. He says there, regarding Satan hindering them in their walk. And he said, for what is our hope or joy or crown of rejoicing? Are not ye in the presence of the Lord Jesus Christ at his coming? Oh, he's coming, and I have confidence that I will be there and expect to see you there. Then in chapter 4, he says, remember these difficult verses here regarding the resurrection. Then he says in verse 17, then we which are alive and remain shall be caught up together with them in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air, and so we shall ever be with the Lord. And so he says, remember that promise. And he said, if you do, then look to your brother and sister, tell your friends that indeed Jesus is coming and bring to fulfillment the promises made to the fathers of old.